Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Disruptive Business, celebrating those who change the game.
All right, Disruptive Business features cutting-edge organizations and the innovative leaders who guide them. Today's show is brought to you by Minerva Planning Group. I am Dana Barrett, sitting in today for Lee Cantor, and along with me, my co-host, Micah Porter.
Good morning, Dana. How are you?
You know, I'm okay. How are you?
You know, okay is not bad. I was telling folks in the studio just before the show started that my wife has been out of town for 2 days, and I've been watching my 3.5-month-old and my sick cat. So I'm glad to be in the studio and out of the condo.
You know, I have to say that having had sick pets, I think, and having had a baby at one time in my life, the cat might actually be harder than the baby.
At 5 o'clock this morning, trying to give her medication, it was.
Yeah, I have a dog, right? I have a small dog who is dealing with one of those cones right now. And just getting the cone on him is probably the funniest thing. Oh, the poor little guy. Anyway. All right, we're going to disrupt some things today.
All right, let's get started.
Let's disrupt. First of all, we've got three guests in the studio. Don Turner, President and CEO of Veloxity. Welcome, Don.
Thank you.
And we have to teach everybody how to use the mics. Don's misbehaving already. Breaking the rules.
I'll try to get better.
Disrupting
I
things.
More quickly.
Look, he can be taught. I love it. Also in the studio, we have Abraham Siong and Randy Mitchell from Plissen. Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So we're going to kind of break this up, Micah, as we like to do, and sort of focus on Veloxity and on Don first.
Sure.
So take it away.
Sure. Well, you know, Veloxity, the tagline for Veloxity is software that thinks. They work with artificial intelligence. And Don, I think the first question would be, what is artificial intelligence and how does Veloxity use it?
Sure. Well, I guess if we're going to define artificial intelligence, we should define intelligence first off.
Sure.
Especially in this room, Don.
Exactly. Well, the old joke is, you know, is artificial intelligence and natural stupidity?
But, I love it.
Intelligence is typically defined as the ability to respond flexibly, to recognize the relative importance of things, to be able to take a look at ambiguous information and make sense of it, and to make rational decisions. That's what intelligence is. That's what humans do. And artificial intelligence is software that emulates those characteristics. It can look at information, ambiguous information, contradictory information. It can prioritize. It can determine what's important, what's not important, and it can make a decision in a rational basis that emulates how a human would make a decision.
Okay. All right. Well, you know, I have been a computer user myself from way back. I had a Commodore 64 early on.
You're dating yourself.
I know. Having said that, though, one of the first sort of, and before that, I worked on minis, mini computers, a Data General. Went to
Are
computer
you going
to
tell
camp.
Me you use punch cards?
I did, actually.
I did, too, but I used them to take notes on.
I did. Well, I remember a program way back when that was called ELIZA. And it was a natural language processor out of Princeton, I think it was, and you'd type in your questions, and it acted like a virtual, I guess, therapist, you'd say. Obviously, artificial intelligence has come a long way since ELIZA. So how has it evolved over time?
Well, artificial intelligence as a practice has evolved over the last 60 years, and it's had stops and starts. In fact, there's a period of time where they had something called the AI winter, because early on, AI had a lot of successes. People started promising grandiose successes, and they couldn't deliver. So there's actually a period of time where AI was not very popular. And the problem with AI is severalfold. One is if you ask 12 AI experts to define AI, you're going to get 12 different answers. It's kind of like the 12 blind men touching the elephant, trying to figure out what animal they're touching. The second thing is, it's analogous to today's science fiction is tomorrow's science. Today's artificial intelligence is tomorrow's off-the-shelf technology. Voice recognition, which we all take for granted, at one point in time was considered artificial intelligence. Pattern recognition for checking your license plates when you go through the toll booth on Georgia 400, that used to be considered artificial intelligence. It's not. Today it's off-the-shelf software. And the other thing that AI gleams itself from so many other practices, AI takes information from psychology, economics, computer science, biology, neuroscience, a bunch of different disciplines. So it's really difficult to pin it down. And in many cases, AI has got a bad rap. We tend to use intelligent systems, but if it looks like a duck and it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, it's AI. So We still use that term.
Right. So basically, you define AI if you can check off a couple of boxes in terms of what it's able to do, as opposed to how it's coded
Well, there's two major areas in the world of AI. There's those that are trying to emulate actually how the human brain and neural system works.
Right.
And the other ones, in essence, don't care and say, what is it output? The first one would be analogous to trying to emulate a bird. The first early planes had flapping wings. The second school of thought in AI says we don't care about flapping wings. We just want to be able to fly.
Right.
And jet airplanes don't have flapping wings. So the question is whether it operates humanly or behaves humanly.
Right.
And most of the work that we're doing, all the work that we're doing and most of the work that's being done right now is really in the latter camp, where they're trying to get something that, independent of how it gets there, that it behaves, thinks, and responds like a human would.
And that's what you're working with at Velocity.
Absolutely.
That's your aim.
We call intelligent agents.
Okay. All right. And the intelligent agent is what gives you that output that requires something akin to intelligence to get there.
An intelligent agent is a software program that emulates how a human thinks. It takes in input.
Okay.
It has a belief system. It monitors itself. And then when something hits a monitor threshold, it executes a plan to a goal, and just like a human would.
And I know you do some work with the military as well as some commercial applications.
Absolutely. Most of our work to date has been with the military. We are just now relaunching the company and with a big focus in the commercial space.
Okay. All right.
So let me ask, what specifically, like what kinds of products, who's your client? Who are you after?
Well, I guess the best way right now would be to give you an example. We still call the Warfighter Associate. The Warfighter Associate is a piece of software that assists a commander sitting in a battalion headquarters of 300 to 1,000 men. He's got computer schemes in front of him. And what we're doing is we're helping him. We're taking a small part. We're not replacing his entire between-the-ears brain functions. What we're trying to do is take a small part of what he does, amplify it in order to assist him. And again, a quick definition, intelligent agents are completely closed-looped, intelligent entities that made out of software, and an intelligent associate is an agent with a human in the loop. So obviously for military and healthcare, we have a human in the loop. But the warfighters...
So let me just interrupt you for a second. So I think the thing that scares people when they hear AI, right, is like that whole sci-fi thing where it takes over and
Terminator,
it makes the decisions.
Big Brother, 1984.
We're prepared for our computer overlords, yes.
Right. So, but putting a human in the loop, you're hopefully eliminating that danger. Is that...
Well, yeah, you're going to have a human in the loop for our lifetime and in military and healthcare applications where, you know, it's mission critical. But you asked kind of an example of how this works.
Yeah.
So you've got a commander, and he's looking at a bunch of screens that tells him where all his air assets are, his ground assets, and things like that. And he tells the lieutenant in charge of the platoon, I want you to go into that apartment building in Kabul, Afghanistan. And it's a valid order. He's one of your best commanders.
Right.
But what he doesn't know, because at most a human can maybe monitor 10 chat rooms. There's thousands and thousands upon chat rooms that are associated with the DOD and the intelligence agencies. That commander might make a better decision. In fact, he might make a different decision if he knew that in chat room 7,322, an intelligence agency just posted an intercepted phone call from a person of interest mentioning that address, mentioning that troops. He might say, Lieutenant, do not go in that building. I think you're walking into a trap. Back off. We'll cordon off the building. So what we've done there is we've taken that commander's ability to look at 10 chat rooms and multiplied it to look at thousands and thousands and thousands in order to help him make a better decision.
So in other words, it's smart enough to pick out pertinent information for him because it has that AI in the background.
In that particular case, it knows the entire Universal Land Warfare Manual. It knows all the battle drills. It knows what the orders of the days are. It is an intelligent entity that is there to assist.
Got it.
The commander.
How does that transition to the commercial space?
Well, there's numerous applications, and I wish I had all the answers, but I don't. We're still trying to figure them out. We're in the early stages of really bringing this type of technology into the commercial world. But the applications are, you know, in healthcare, you could have a pulmonologist intelligent agent to assist nurses and doctors in how to deal with various pulmonology problems. You could have a system where a hedge fund trader looks at 50 different documents every morning in order to make certain trades. We can set it up so he still looks at 50, but that 50 is not just the 50 he picked. It's 50 that's been derived from looking at 100,000 documents and saying these are the 50 most important you need to look at. Because we work with big data. We're not a big data company per se. We would like to say is we make big data smarter. if you take a billion spreadsheets and boil them down to one spreadsheet and a human still has to look at it and make a decision, that's where we can come in. We can emulate that human.
If I were a client, let's say I was the hedge fund trader, for example, would I need to reformat the data such that your system could use it, or does it literally go out, pull in the various sources that I indicate, and parse it as it needs to parse it for the decisions that I want to make?
We can work with unstructured data. In fact, with our Warfire associate, we do a lot of natural language processing.
Okay.
And so, you know, we're going to live in a world of heterogeneous data. That's just a, you know, unstructured data. That's a fact of life. So if you're in the software world, you better know how to do it.
Right.
Well, and then if I'm the hedge fund manager, I'm a much better looking hedge fund manager than Mike. I'm just saying.
Thanks for it. Face for radio.
No problem. If I'm the hedge fund manager now, on the, I want to ask the same question, but on the front loading side, how much do I have to tell you in order for your system to learn what I'm looking for?
Well, we talked about a 3.5-month-old baby. How much do you think you'll have to do over the next 18 years in terms of educating your child?
Boy, there's an open-ended question to which okay. I have no answer.
There's a lot. So the way to think about this is in 9 months, you don't give birth to a complete college graduate PhD.
I did.
To do a job.
No, kidding.
What we do is we work with companies, because this is new technology, to help them develop pilots, whether it's an insurance company or a financial company or a healthcare company, is we build a little baby.
Yeah.
And it's smart. It says mommy and daddy, and when you scratch on the cheek, it smiles. But it's intelligent. They can see that it reacts, and it's alive. Then once they say, my goodness, this is alive, then we start educating it, and we make it smarter and smarter. With our Warfighter associate, we've been training that system, and it just gets smarter all the time. You know, it's been going on for about 2 years right now, and it's pretty darn smart.
So in other words, it gets better over time.
It gets better,
that's
better
like
over time.
Micah gets better over time.
Thank you.
Building additional intelligence in it. Or what we're also right now is we're on the cutting edge of some machine learning concepts, so the machine can actually learn on its own.
That's the scary part, I think.
Well, now I imagine if you start with a smart baby, if you will, every project that you've got is a custom project, and I imagine that there's nothing that is off the shelf here. You're dealing with big projects and big needs.
Twofold. One, we do have a development environment where we develop these custom intelligent agents for a company.
Okay.
We are right now looking at several verticals where our business model is to provide a development environment for people for the first time to build intelligent agents. Because you got to remember, for the longest time, there was maybe the number of people that could really build intelligent agents you could fit in a high school basketball gymnasium and
sure.
have room for the volleyball court.
Right.
There wasn't many of them.
Right.
What we did, and we started over a year ago, and we've got just an absolutely phenomenal technology team. In fact, if you ever want to get your IQ cranked up 10 points, come into our office and just breathe the air, and I guarantee you'll get smarter. That's how I get my fix every day. I go
right.
and breathe some air, and I'm a little bit smarter that day. But the other part of what we're doing is we're also looking at certain verticals where we will develop an intelligent agent that we can scale. So we're looking at both of those. And the third areas we're looking at is literally joint ventures,
okay.
where people have strong domain experience, strong relationships, and they're visionaries. They want to change how that marketplace is operating.
Right.
They want fundamental change, because this is a game changer when you apply this in. And we've already got one joint venture with a company that's on this convergence of entertainment, B2C marketing, and social media.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to use our intelligent agents. And an example we mentioned a little bit ago about how this might work with Warfighter Associate is we talked to this one guy who's forgot more about social media marketing than I will ever know. But he said, look, if you put everything out on the table, all the demographics, all the artists, what the brands want, give me a week, I'll come up with a great marketing plan. They don't want to do one a week. They want to do one a second. So they're going to be using our intelligent agent technology in order to build and emulate part of that expert's thought process so they can do it very fast.
And I take it that target on the verticals and the use of joint ventures, is that how you're really promoting the software within the commercial space?
Yes, right now it is. We're working for joint ventures and also for, you know, corporations that are dealing with the pain that everybody's getting right now. There is a tremendous shortfall of what they call STEMs in this country, scientific, technical, engineering, and medical personnel. Gardner says just in the advanced analytics, there'll be 140,000 to 170,000 jobs where they can't fill in 2014. They also say that in the next 2-3 years, we're going to need 1.5 million new managers to know how to deal with this big data. I mean, I hear people say, you know, the buzzword du jour right now is big data, and they say, I'm so excited to work with big data. And I said, if you really knew what you're talking about, you'd be scared witless. Big data is not the solution. It's the problem. And, again, we can work with the big data companies in applying intelligence to them. And taking a company that's got 200 people doing something, insurance underwriting, medical coding, whatever, and saying, I, first of all, I can't find any more people like this. I've got a labor shortage. Or I can't afford to hire and double, go up to 400 or 500 people. Just like in the Warfighter Associate, we had one commander essentially doing, I can't give you the full number because this goes across international borders, but let's say he's doing the work of thousands of commanders
right.
in that particular area of what he was looking at in terms of situational awareness. That's what we can do for companies is amplify and magnify their current performance.
Let me ask you something about sort of the commercial side of things. We had a show not too long ago with some attorneys, and they were talking about you know, being an attorney now versus being an attorney 20 years ago. And the reason I bring it up is just because what they were talking about is everyone's sort of desire to have something not yesterday, but like 3 weeks ago, where in the old days, I want it yesterday or I needed it an hour ago. Now it's like everything has to be done at the speed of light because of all the technology that's out there. I think people feel like they're entitled to everything should be right at their fingertips. You shouldn't have to wait. You know, remember when we used to push the button and the modem would, you'd hear the dial tone and you would slowly wait to connect
right.
online, and then you would wait for your screen to paint and you just sat there patiently, you know, maybe knitting a sweater or filing your nails or
having
whatever.
A little chai tea.
Exactly.
Listening to some music.
There's no way at this point. If something is slow, we're impatient, we're banging on the table, and we're, and obviously being able to, you know, comb through 100,000 pieces of data as fast as somebody else would comb through, you know, personally 50 pieces of data is a huge speed thing. So I'm sure with, again, the buzzword of big data and all these people in that space, there's a lot of people trying to sort of compete and get that business. So are you, what are you doing that's sort of different than your competitors to
well,
bring that speed
like
to market?
Well, like I said, we're not a big data company per se. We
right.
work with the big data companies,
right.
the ones that are processing and getting them down and taking these 300 billion messages a day and making some sense of it, looking at patterns, things like that. But when it still comes down to where a human has to make a decision, that's where we come in. Because right now, even your experts are getting overwhelmed. I heard a statistic, in fact, earlier this morning, was that since every 2 days today, the world creates about 5 petabytes of data, 1 × 10^15, okay? Since 2003, or I guess, yeah, in 2 days, the world creates more data than the entire civilization of mankind from when the cavemen were dragging their knuckles and painting pictographs on a wall to 2003. In 2 days, we create more data than the world did in that entire time frame. So the data is overwhelming, and the problem you've got is you can either ignore the data or find smart ways to go about it. We work on the latter. I mean, you talk about a physician right now. How many years you have to go in? How many new findings and conclusions and information is available for a physician? How do you keep up? You can't.
Yeah.
And we can help build intelligent agents that are there to assist you and take that part of your thought process for your particular job and put it on Uber speed.
Well, you know, what's interesting about the physician example is with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act and the shortage of primary care physicians out there, the ability to emulate that, the ability to act as a, the ability to emulate the knowledge of the physician to some extent.
Absolutely.
Acts as a real force multiplier in an area in which there's going to be an incredible demand for that.
Well, you mentioned a great term that we use a lot in the military, force multiplication.
Sure.
And that's exactly what we do, is force multiplication in the commercial market. We talk to a healthcare system where they've got a limited number of pulmonologists and they have multiple ICUs and they can't be there 7 by 24. They were looking for an intelligent agent that would allow a nurse or a non-pulmonologist to assist them until a pulmonologist could get there. Part of what we do is our technology is based on a concept or a paradigm called the OODA loop, observe, orient, decide, and act. And that is a decision-making cycle. We can go into detail at some point in time about Colonel John Boyd, but it's actually now being used to train paramedics and other people that are dealing with a lot of decisions in a rapidly changing environment with a lot of data.
It started with fighter pilots, didn't it?
Yeah. John Boyd was a United States Air Force pilot in Korean War and Vietnam War, and he was undefeated, and as a trainer, he was known as 42nd Boyd because he would let you get on his six, and he bet you $100 that he could get on your six within 40 seconds, and he never, ever lost the bet. What he did is he was a brilliant military strategist, and he came up with the idea of getting in your decision cycle. The faster I can either observe orient, decide, and act than you, whether it's a fighter pilot or in a business situation, the more competitive and the better chance of victory that I have. And so what we've done is we've taken that OODA loop concept and we've built an intelligent agent technology system specifically based on that OODA loop concept.
And in terms of looking at the commercial market, could you just revisit for a second the verticals that you're focusing on right now? Who are your ideal clients in the commercial side?
Our ideal clients, and we're not focusing specifically on the verticals right now because, quite frankly, we just aren't smart enough.
Okay.
As we launch this is disruptive technology. It's game-changing technology. And I've worked on a bunch of different high-tech marketplaces. If it's truly high-tech, the customer, the client, the user, they don't know what's possible. I mean, if you take a look at the Sony Walkman that you put on your belt with some headphones, that was not developed by asking people what they wanted because they were walking around these big boom boxes with 12D batteries weighing 20 pounds. All they wanted was a better pad so it didn't hurt their shoulder so much.
As someone that used punch cards, I can tell you that the Walkman blew my mind when it came out.
Well, what Sony did, and that's exactly what we're doing, what Sony did is, okay, I mean, the essence of strategy is to identify macro trends that you're willing to invest in. They said, look, the macro trend is that people are listening to music more and more in a mobile fashion. How can we change what they do with the voodoo we do? So they literally, they had a core competency in electronic miniaturization, and they took that 20-pound boom box and put it down to something you put on your belt buckle and on your belt. Nobody asked them for that because they didn't know it was possible. So as we talk to companies and they talk about intelligent agent technology, I mean, if we really want to get their eyes glazed over, we talk about hierarchical cognitive interventions, but they don't know what's possible.
Right.
So we right now are focused specifically for the next 6 months in the metropolitan Atlanta area, talking to corporations that have got labor shortages, that are looking for ways to deal with the problems they have today, where they want to get new levels of productivity. And so we're, you know, obviously in Atlanta, we're going to be talking to financial companies, mobile companies, and healthcare companies is really the big three that we're looking at and applying intelligent agents there. And we make it easy for them. We say, look at for, you know, you don't have to buy on the whole concept, but give us a little money and give us some of your expertise and we'll build you a baby and you'll see that this works.
So before we move on to our very patient Plissen guys sitting on the other side of the room, Don, if people want to learn more about Velocity and about what you're doing, what's the best way for them to get information?
Call, write, carrier pigeon. We'll put a shelf out on the front. If you go out to velocity.com, V as in Victor, ELOXITI.com, there's many ways to contact us and read about us in terms of what we're doing. And our whole objective is simply to get people intrigued. If they're interested in what's next, how do you know what is the next big movement in the area of computer science and how computers are going to help humans make better decisions, give us a call and we'll talk to you.
Well, and before I let you off the hook completely, I have to ask if there's any plans to have any AI that will be walking around, you know, like a little robot.
Dana, we're going to indulge your phobia here, are we?
I just want to know if I have to worry about like an army of robots like in the movie iRobot coming to get me. I'm just wondering.
Well, there's a two-part answer to that. Eventually, the answer is obviously yes.
What? Okay.
Okay. but you have literally, they look like big walking dogs right now. If you go out to YouTube and you Google in big dog, you will see a walking robot. And the challenge then is continue to put more intelligence on them right now. Right now, there's not a lot of intelligence on the robots themselves.
Sure. Is that anything that your company will get involved with, or are you going to stick with that?
We have actually put some significant investment in the area of robotics, and we're waiting for the market to be ready to really make these robots smart and not to make them fully autonomous. What we see is semi-autonomous robotic collaboration where three or four robots on a battlefield or in an airspace can interact with each other. And, you know, I'll give you one last thing. We did a demonstration for the FAA where we showed all these air traffic controllers and all these pilots talking to each other, interacting, and then a weather storm came in and they had to reroute all the planes. And then we tell them, there isn't a single human involved here. These are all intelligent agents, and we use text-to-speech synthesization so you can hear what they're saying and how they're interacting, but they're actually talking to each other.
Well, wow. We're dealing in one of my phobias now. I'm afraid of flying, so that's interesting to know.
So this is a show. This is not a show about disruptive business. It's a show about Micah and Dana's terror, night terrors and fears. Okay. Let's move on and talk to our other guests.
Thanks very much, Don. If we could get started now with Randy and Abraham. Mm-hmm. Tell us a bit about Plissen. What is Plissen?
All right, so, excuse me. Plissen is the easiest way for consumers to be able to communicate with brands, whether it's brands they care about or whether it's brands that they want to hold accountable or have some measure of organized communication with.
sort of a complaint box, an area that you can provide feedback on products you'd like to see? What sort of communication do you think you'll facilitate?
Right. So not so much of a complaint box, although I think a lot of, you know, the beginning of Plissin started with some, you know, bad brand experiences and the thought that there should be a better way to communicate with brands and in the instances where it's necessary to hold them accountable, but also to lift up the brands that do a great job. So Plissin is more than that. So what we've found out in the early parts of customer development is that we want to address some of the early needs that we're finding that people have. One example, which is organization. So I think the first piece is giving people a very clean, simple, easy, and organized way to communicate with brands. So go ahead.
As opposed to pulling in multiple emails and websites and RSS feeds and things like that.
That's exactly right. We went out and we talked to over 100 people, and we found out specifically from women, the demographics broke up to about 70% women, 30% men. What we found out is that these women are having an incredibly difficult time parsing and sorting through the massive amounts of data that brands are pushing their way. So, you know, to your point, as you were saying, they've signed up with, you know, email subscription lists. They've downloaded mobile apps to their phone. They've connected across multiple social networks. They've signed up for daily deal sites. The list goes on. And so what we've discovered is that what a lot of people are dealing with right now is marketing channel overload. It's too much information from too many different directions, too much noise.
I could totally relate. I think I might have been one of the 100. I wasn't, actually, but I could be, because I get so many emails every day in my inbox. I want to like tear my hair out sometimes. Right. But I can't just delete them all, because there might be that one piece of information that I really wanted to know.
That's exactly right.
So, I'm sorry, go ahead, Dan.
I was going to say, so what do you guys do that fixes that?
So I think a lot of times, you know, as we were talking, me and my buddy Abraham were talking the other day, and there's this quote in Lord of the Rings where Frodo drops the ring and Boromir picks it up and he says, man, you know, such a, you know, interesting thing, so much fear and doubt over so small a thing, such a little thing. What I found is that a lot of times the biggest solution is, I guess, a very simple answer. And so what we've done with Plissin is we've given people a way. So as an example, you would come to our application and you would sign in through, say, for instance, a Facebook or Twitter. We glean information from your social graph, and it could be as simple as male or female, but, you know, it could go deeper than that. And based on that information, we're able to serve up brands that might be relevant to you. Now, from there, that's where human interaction starts to kind of take place. And what you do is tell us, based on those brands that we serve up, hey, here are the brands that are interesting to me. Here are the ones I consume from. Here are the ones I care about. And you're able to start to add those brands to what we call our brand board. And that brand board is this central organized space where every brand that you care about is in this one central place. And so you don't have to go back out to the web and search for it again. If you want information about that brand, you just open up your application. You go to a very visual experience and you click through to Banana Republic or to
Why'd you look right at me when you said Banana Republic?
Well, you know, I don't know if you like Banana Republic.
It might be in their target market, maybe. Just perhaps the sweater is from there.
If Dana were to if Dana were to download your app, is part of what it's doing gaining access to, you mentioned her social graph. Mm-hmm. Is it gaining access to the Facebook information via the API or Twitter or things like that? How do you construct the social graph?
Right. So the whole idea of open information, the open internet, a lot of companies have been they're generous with the information that we share, and that's something that we believe in, is that, you know, it makes life easier when information is available to all. And so, yeah, that social graph data, you know, you pull in from Facebook's API or from Twitter's API, whether it's a ton of information or just a little bit. Hmm. As Dana uses the application more, obviously we're going to learn more about her, but it gives us a very simple way in the beginning to say, hi, you know, let's get to know each other. Tell us a little bit about yourself so that we can make your experience on Plissin more relevant.
You know, it's interesting. I know a lot of companies are sort of trying to, in their own way, for their own evil needs, sure, trying to get at what I'm doing.
Right.
And I received an email the other day from one of my credit card companies that said, you know, here, click through here and sign up for all the deals you want for December. And I clicked through and it was a list of maybe 20 deals. And first of all, it annoys me. This is a side note, but it annoys me that I have to sign up. If you want to give me the deal, just freaking give me the deal. Why do I have to sign up? Anyway, there's 20 deals on there, and about 10 or 11 of them were specifically for Roswell, Georgia. And that's because I used to live in Roswell, Georgia. But the thing is, I haven't lived there for 2 years, and I now live in Midtown. And my bank that has my credit card should know that, because they mail my statement to Midtown, and they've been doing that for 2 years. So clearly something is wrong with their AI or their lack of AI. And in your case, maybe a specific application that they're using old data to keep up with me, which is actually more annoying than if they had just gotten it right.
You echo a very prominent issue that, you know, is starting to be written about quite a bit on the web, and that's that people want a more personalized experience from the brands they communicate with. They believe that, hey, I spent all this time and all this money, communicating with you, and I want you to know more about me. And so what we're creating with Plissken is, I think, one of the beginning ways that we start to do that, and letting you curate the content that brands send to you on your own terms, in terms of what you want to hear from them and how often you want to hear from them. And the great thing from brands is that, you know, like you said, you know, sometimes people may feel like, you know, that the conversation thus far has been very one way. It's, you know, brands pushing out information to consumers. What we think is the growing trend in the direction that things are going is more of a mutual relationship, not unlike a marriage. I mean, the two parties need one another. You know, brands drive our market. They give consumers things that we need, things that we want, but they wouldn't exist if there weren't people like you and I to purchase those products. And so it really is a very symbiotic relationship, and that's what we're building with Plissken, something that moves us, you know, further to that marriage as opposed to, you know, whatever else you want to call it.
And that's where our name comes from. Plissken comes from the word please listen, right? Listening to the consumer, listening to the constituents, listening to the audience, versus just a one-way communication from the brand or the politician or the company.
I know that you've both just gotten back from an accelerator program out in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
So you're intimately familiar with your business plan at this point, I have no doubt. Who is the paying client in this model?
So the paying client that we see, obviously, are brands. We found out some interesting information as we did customer development that certain people are willing to pay for this product. But what we wanted to do, there was a study done, I believe, by Forrester Research and PivotCon. We did a white paper on it prior to being accepted into the accelerator. And the question was, why aren't more brands listening and engaging? And so they cited two of the main reasons. There were other ones, but two of the main reasons they didn't listen is, for one, they said it costs too much. Secondly, they didn't want to have to manage multiple technologies. And so what we really want to do is, there's an altruistic goal with Plissken, because it came from personal pain, is to see, you know, really to see, we want to remove the barriers that brands and consumers have to talking to one another. And so, you know, we want to build that tool and give people an opportunity to talk. We do see an opportunity for monetization in terms of data, in terms of revenue share, but in a very non-zero-sum type of way. We want to create something where everybody can win and where it's sustainable over the long term. So that paying customer, it's a very long answer to say the paying customer are brands, but not in the traditional sense,
right,
that you might imagine.
And as far as your end user goes, as far as the consumer goes, it's as simple as downloading the app on an Android or an iPhone.
That's exactly right. They just download, you know, straight to their mobile phone, and the experience begins. And as we continue to develop and build out, you know, the goal is to launch at the tablet level and also on the desktop. There are different use cases and different user experiences that can happen as we move from, you know, the form factor of a small, you know, cell phone device up to a tablet and then to a desktop.
And Micah mentioned earlier when he first started talking to you guys about the complaint side of communication between an individual and a brand. And I know everyone's going to find this hard to believe, but I like to complain.
Sure.
And I've done it quite a bit, actually.
Not so much during this show.
Well, a little bit during this show.
That's true.
The show's not over yet.
That's right.
Good point.
There's still time.
Thanks, Don.
But I think, like, I have said this to many people, and I have done it myself. One of the best ways to complain right now to a brand is either on Facebook or Twitter.
Sure.
Because it is in a public forum, and we've seen it with celebrities doing it. What was Kevin Smith about? Was it Southwest Airlines or one of the airlines about, mm-hmm, you know, being in the seat or whatever? And I just did a story the other day about, I think it was Judy Blume complained on Twitter about Delta Airlines. So really interesting, you know, people are getting out there and voicing their opinions. And of course, brands have to deal with it, but they don't like it.
Right.
So, because, you know, makes them publicly look bad. In the old days, I had to pick up the phone or find that one manager in a store, and nobody knew about the complaint except me and that manager.
Right.
And they could blow me off. They can't do that anymore. So is your application going to provide that kind of forum for people? I guess the question is there a way for brands to manage that and still look good?
Absolutely. So, yeah, so when you go in, and as a matter of fact, I've got an alpha version of our app here, and I'll...
Too bad we're not on TV. We can show it to everyone.
As I talk, I'll kind of, you know, walk you through it. So as you go in and select those categories that are relevant to you, whether they be fashion or electronics or gaming or travel or whatever, and we start to send those brands up to you that might be of interest. As you start to engage those brands, you tell us whether you're a fan, a follower, or a critic. And so right now what you see on the web is a very singular or maybe a dual approach.
Like or not.
Like or not, or plus one. But those tend to be very ambiguous. Like is a very relative term depending upon, you know, why I like that brand. And so we're one of the first, or we are the first application to take a trimodal approach to allow people to specifically say where they stand with the brand.
Say the three again, yeah.
Fan, I love you. I'm a Raven fan. I really appreciate what you're doing, and I'm on Team Apple or Team Samsung.
Right.
Which is funny because they're suing each other right now in court. they both make great products. Just keep making great products, keep innovating, stop suing each other. But anyway, or follower. I'm not really, I don't have a dog in the game. I'm interested. You've said something that was intriguing to me, and I want to know more. Critic, I don't like you, and here's why. And so what happens from there is, so we'll go back as an example to Banana Republic, which is a brand you seem to like. You can go into the feedback section of the app, and you can leave feedback, and you can do it from the perspective of being a fan, follower, or critic. And you can communicate with other people who may share that sentiment. So there's an element of crowdsourcing, both positive, neutral, and negative sentiment, so that brands can see at scale what the issues are, whether good or bad, that are going on, you know, with their particular market. We didn't want Plissken to be an angry place.
I think that's, you know, also an interesting point because, you know, you talk about, let's talk about Banana Republic. If they're listening, they're going to call me up after this probably. But, you know, I am a fan. I like their stuff. I shop there. Great. But I went there a week or so ago and I had a bad experience.
Okay.
And I even said to the girl at the desk, I'll be tweeting about this later. I don't think I actually did and didn't follow up. But the point is that I would be complaining, quote unquote, as a fan, not as a critic, because right. I do really love the brand and I would only be complaining because I want them overall, the company at corporate headquarters, to be aware of the mistakes that are happening on the ground. And I think that is an important distinction, that when you're tweeting in 140 characters, you might just look like a jerk that complains all the time on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. Which makes it more critical for Banana Republic or any other brands. If they see that you're a critic, you're on our platform, but you're a fan, but now you're saying things to make them better.
Right, not just to complain.
There's more value to them
right.
in that. But if you were a critic and you were complaining, it may be less valuable to them. And that's one thing that we're doing that's very unique and disruptive to the industry in some ways is we're not just measuring actions. When somebody goes on a social media site and they push a like button, they're measuring an action. That's just the action. They're not getting the real sentiment of how somebody feel about that brand. And so by offering the fan, follow, and critic option, it allows them to really, the brand to really see the true sentiments of their audience.
You talked about establishing fora for brands. You know, so if I'm a fan of, I'll go with Old Navy. Will I be able
which
to
is still the gap in Banana Republic?
Right. Yeah, it's all one big conglomerate right. at this point. But if I'm a fan of Old Navy, will I be able to sign up as a fan and then go to some sort of forum for Old Navy and see what others are saying about it, or is that simply visible to the brands themselves?
No, so it's visible on both sides. So yes, you'll be able to go to a forum, a feedback forum, and view what other people are saying. And we want to make it specific to your point, Dana. You may be a fan of the brand, but you may be a critic of a specific instance or practice. And so giving the opportunity to be more granular in what you are a fan, follower, or critic of. As an example, if you leave a comment, so you may be a fan of Banana Republic, but if you leave a comment, you can mark that comment as a critic, and other people can come in and say, you know what, I feel the same way, and they can pump that. We have a metric that we call volume, and volume is akin to relevance. So the people can come in and see your comment and go, you know, yes, I'm a fan of your comment, of this critical comment, which kind of increases the volume and allows brands to see that. So what we didn't want was to have people jumping back and forth, oh, I'm a fan today, I'm a critic tomorrow, I'm a fan today, I'm a critic tomorrow. No, that's just, it's very skittish. And oftentimes we are a fan of things. Like, I love my wife, right? But I'm not always a fan.
Not every day.
I love her every day. She maybe, I don't know. I love my wife. I'm not always a fan of everything that she does and vice versa. But it doesn't change the nature of our relationship. You know, I'm committed to her.
That's a great example. I love it.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Good communication is, it's dealing with those negative elements and working to make them better.
Yeah.
While still keeping the same context of the relationship in check. And that's what we're working to accomplish.
Now, before we're getting close to the end of the show, but I want to make sure we get contact information out for you guys. Are you still looking for investment capital? Are you looking for, give me the stage that you're at and,
sure,
how people can engage with you.
Okay. So in terms of engagement, they can find us on the web at plisten.com, and that's plisten.com, P-L-I-S-T-E-N. We are in the investment stage, and so we're going to be we've had some interested parties since we got back from the Accelerator. We're also going to be doing a friends and family round where we're reaching out to people in our community and within our network to do some initial investments, and then going back over to California to raise a more formal seed, so forth and so on.
So you're at the angel round of things right now?
We're at the angel round of things right now, that's correct.
Okay.
So again, plisten.com.
Correct.
Plisten.com.
That's right.
Okay.
And how long before your app appears on the App Store and is available for Android as well?
Right. So out of love and respect for my technical team, I will not commit to a date, but I will say that we're working very fast. We've got our alpha built right now. We're working very fast to launch in the both Google Play or Android market as well as the App Store. And so it should be coming soon to a app marketplace near you.
All right, excellent.
Before we wrap up completely, we're starting a new tradition here on Disruptive Business Radio, where we want to know a little bit more about you guys. So clearly, Vloxity and Plisten are both disruptive to the marketplace. But what we want to know is, in what ways has being involved in your businesses disrupted your own life, and how are you managing that disruption? So Don, we're going to bring it back to you.
Okay, a question I wasn't ready for.
We like to disrupt things here and keep you on your toes.
There you go. It's working with Vloxity for the last 18 months. First off, I work with two phenomenally great types of people. So first off, some very smart people. And secondly, I also work with some military veterans, which is a true honor to work with them. And I'm passionate and intense anyways, and it's simply taken that and it's magnified it orders of magnitude, because as I mentioned before the show, I've had the opportunity to work in a lot of different technologies, including computer simulation and internets and supercomputers and things like that. And we are working with something that eventually will change the world. And the question is when and how, but not if. And so working with this company is literally just has me jumping out of bed every morning, wanting to put that little ding in the universe, as Steve said. And so it really hasn't disrupted my life. It's amplified it.
Excellent. And you, Plisten guys, is your wife now a fan of yours, or is she a critic with all this disruption in her life?
No, she is a fan. She tells me all the time that I'm a champion. We went to, as an example, went to Silicon Valley not long ago. I was out there for 3 months. And I've got her and my, two small kids back at home. But that was something that we talked about, that we decided on. It was going to be a great thing to do. And she's very supportive. And this is not quite in context, but I feel like I want to jump into it, because the whole notion of a disruptive technology and disruptive things, it's like there's this other idea that I had the opportunity to hear. Jack Dorsey, I went to TechCrunch Disrupt while I was out in the West Coast, and Jack Dorsey, who's the founder of Twitter and Square and so forth, went up and gave a speech about the idea of disruptive technology and disrupting. He says, we don't need disruption, we need revolution. And that's a thing that really resonated with me, and a conviction that I shared, long before I heard Jack talk about it. But the idea of revolution, there's another word in there, which is evolution, and it's the growth of things. He says that revolution has purpose, it has order, it has a direction, it has leaders. Disruption oftentimes is just kind of a big confusing agitation, which needs to happen, oftentimes for us to evolve. But yeah, I think, what Don is building here, what we're working to build at Plisten, is about helping the world and people and markets and ideas evolve. And to become better and to grow beyond where we are right now. But back to your point about the family, no, my family has been very supportive, and I'm grateful for that because it wouldn't be possible without that. So, and not very disruptive. I just missed my kids for 3 months.
Aw. And Abraham, do you want to share how this disruption is affecting your life?
I'll be very brief. You know, anytime you're involved in a new startup, especially if you're not at the funded stage yet, you have to wrap your life around the startup.
We're funded with sweat.
Yeah, and you call it sweat equity because you're sweating. So I guess the disruption for us is just a lot of hours, midnight, you know, working the late into the night and doing some data crunching, doing some investment of time. So that's probably the biggest change for us.
And Micah, any thoughts to wrap us up for the day?
Sure. Well, I think the idea of disruption within an entrepreneurial context is unavoidable. It's about what it's the foundation of being an entrepreneur, I think. And what's so important from my perspective is that we've all got plans for our businesses if they're going to be successful. You cannot not have a plan for your business, but you need to know what you want out of that business for your personal life. But, you know, Randy, as you said, you also need the buy-in from your family. Yeah. And I think if you've got those two things, the success in business just spills over into your personal life. And it's a place that not very many people have the privilege to find themselves.
Absolutely. All right. Well, this has been Disruptive Business Radio. I want to thank Abraham and Randy from Plissen and Don Turner from Velocity. And of course, Micah Porter, my co-host. I am Dana Barrett, and we will see you back here in 2 weeks after the holiday.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dana.